Some just lie. Mm. And some of them are too naive. Mm. So you quickly become a reader of human beings as a successful lawyer, at least a lawyer. Mm. And you can smell and sense, and your antenna is up for the personality and character of the client sitting in front of you. You need to know when to cajole him, mm. when to handhold him, when to smack the hell out of him, to tell him to get lost from your office. But by and large, to make him feel that you are his trusted advisor, mm. that you are lawyer plus. Mm. That is really a lawyer's place in the sun.
Hello and welcome to the 17th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast series. I'm Deepak Jayaraman, the creator and curator of this series of conversations. I'm an executive coach and do work in the space of leadership development, but with a specific focus on leadership transitions, both in the context of companies and careers. You could visit transitioninsight.com for details. My objective from this podcast is to have learning conversations from a range of people and share those curated insights with you. This time, I'm excited to be talking to Zia Modi. Zia Modi is an Indian legal consultant and is considered an authority on corporate merger and acquisition law, securities law, private equity, and project finance. She is an alumnus of Harvard Law School and worked for 5 years in the US with Baker & McKinsey in New York before returning to India. She started her own practice in Mumbai in 1984, and over the years, she's built AZB & Partners, one of India's largest and most reputed law firms, where she's the managing partner. She's frequently appeared on Most Powerful Businesswomen and Most Powerful CEO lists over the last several years. In our conversation, we spoke about her take on how people should think about law as a career, her take on women growing on to become leaders and the leaky pipeline, what it takes to be a trusted advisor with a client, what it takes to have a sense of judgment, what it takes to build an institution of repute, and more. Without further ado, over to my conversation with Zia. Zia, thanks for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
Pleasure.
This podcast, as you know, is titled Play to Potential, which is about having conversations with leaders on their journeys. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to rewind the clock.
Sure.
And one thing I'm curious about in how leaders are born or get made is the early formative years. So would love to get your perspectives on your early childhood years, if you will, growing up to college. If you had to reflect on what are the things that got formed in you, which still form a core part of who you are and has played a core role in your growth and success?
Sure. So, you know, as you have figured, and as is the reality, your backbone and character is really shaped in the years when you spend time with family, with siblings, on the dining table, on vacations. And so I would say that my formative years were really probably between 7 to 15, 16, where there was a lot of pressure on us to perform very well academically. Sometimes I think too pressured. Mm-hmm. There was a mother who was a homemaker and who was there for us. My father was very busy as a very successful lawyer, really a weekend father, but mm-hmm. a loving weekend father. Mm-hmm. And so really what we did every day was decided by my mother. Mm-hmm. And I think that the formative years, really, I was overdriven. I had to learn every vocation. Mm-hmm. I had to excel in academia. I had to try and be the perfect girl, but yet a very driven girl. And so I think those were my formative years, really. Fairly stressed, happy stressed. So I used to go riding. I used to swim. I used to do a lot of girly things like knitting and crochet and cooking. And of course, like all Parsi families, the usual piano playing.
Right.
But all, I think, with a view to making, where are my capabilities the best? I think that is, I think, what my mother tried to figure. Mm-hmm. And so all of our siblings did everything that could possibly fill in their 24-hour day, just so that we could find ourselves, so to speak. So those were our formative years.
Interesting. And just the one thing I'm curious about, especially in India, which is a country obsessed with engineering, medicine, accounting, and some of those professions, I'm curious about your take on how should people at the cusp of making a choice think about law as a direction, you know, given the journey you've had and the journeys of other lawyers you've seen, what are the 2-3 questions people should ask themselves for them to say that might be a career worth pursuing?
So I think, you know, law has become so much more attractive now in the last 10 to 15 years for a couple of reasons. One is the starting compensation, which is always a worry for any youngster who's taken loans or has taken money from their parents, is pretty good. Mm-hmm. So earlier, where you would start with a pittance, mm-hmm. now you would start with a very decent base salary. So the attraction to law as a good financial start to a young career exists.
Okay.
Now, that's the money part.
Right.
The real plus, I think, in choosing to do law, if you are so minded, is that there is no downside, in the sense that, couple of things, you can study law and you can go on to study something else. Mm-hmm. You can practice law, but you can go on to be something else. Mm-hmm. You have to practice law, but you have so many now choices in which to be a lawyer. So earlier, the choices really were, did you go to court? Or did you become a solicitor and mm-hmm. do table work? Mm-hmm. Now you can be an in-house counsel. You can be a lawyer to private equity. Mm. And if you look at the stats, there are some pretty interesting stats where a lot of global CEOs were former lawyers.
Very interesting.
So the switch from being a lawyer with all the traditional stereotype lines that you would like to give it, mm-hmm. the flexibility of what you can do once you become a lawyer has, I think, today increased manifold.
Very interesting. But from a personality trait perspective, are there one or two traits that that stand out?
Yeah, well, you know, the stereotype traits stand out, but not all lawyers have them. And that does not mean that those who don't have them are not successful. Mm-hmm. So I would say, obviously, the traits that stand out are logic. Mm-hmm. So everybody assumes everybody's intelligent. So no point saying a lawyer has to be intelligent.
That's hygiene, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Logic stands out. And a huge amount of attention to detail. Hmm. So I'm assuming everybody has the hard work quota, everybody has the passion quota.
Fair.
But the attention to detail is, I think, much more rigorous, a requirement in a lawyer, simply because... what is a successful lawyer at the end of the day? He is one that has the ability to marshal every fact in the matter and to bring out an argument that veers the success factor best in his favor.
Right.
That is not possible unless you know every single fact. Hmm. That is not possible unless you pay attention to these facts. Hmm. So that is why a successful lawyer, according to me, is one that knows more of the fact pattern than his opponent.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And sort of the ability to connect the dots using logic to sort of make a persuasive argument. Very interesting. And the other related question I ask people is sort of the type 1 and type 2 errors. And what I mean by that is...
So we are type 1.
Huh?
A-type personality, if so that's where you're going.
Then the other statistical context is people that never... one is people that choose law but end up very quickly realizing it's not their cup of tea. And the other is people that go on to do other things but actually could have been great lawyers. Any reflection on that?
Well, you know, who knows? You can always get into a career that wasn't the best for you. Misguided lawyers don't last too long because the peer pressure will weed them out. Unless they're willing to just be soft souls that are here for a job. That's in any career, right? But if you've got a really good incisive, bright person who actually dies, dying to be a musician, what do? You go where your heart takes you, right, at the end of the day.
Right.
I've never seen a successful lawyer who's not passionate about what he does, doesn't sustain.
Which is true for
and for any anything. Profession, yeah, so that's it.
Got it. And the other related thing I was hearing one of your conversations, Zia, was about in the context of your transition back from the US to India. At some point, you spoke about spending a year not charging any fees, but building relationships. Terrible. But I'm curious about that notion of having an investing phase when people transition careers. Any reflections on that, specifically in the context of your transition?
I suppose it's if you can afford it.
Hmm.
At the end of the day, I could afford to do work for free.
Hmm.
A youngster who came back with a large loan and a middle-class family would not have that luxury.
Hmm.
It's all about what you're able to do, you see.
Hmm.
But clearly when you're transitioning, at least I was not transitioning into a different career. I was a lawyer. It's disruptive. It's simply disruptive. It's the culture. It's the gender. It's the domain. It's the smell on the street. It's everything.
Hmm.
For me, coming back from New York to a small little table which I had to share was pretty depressing.
You spoke about gender, right, Zia? Again, talking about women in leadership. In your head, specifically in law, what's your take on the glass ceilings in people's heads? You know, one is clearly there's been enough commentary around what's there in the system. But in your head, if you had to talk to the young women aspiring leaders, where do you think there are the glass ceilings in their head, which could be...
I think 80% of them have glass ceilings in their head still.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a function of, like in every profession, women think they really have to outpace the men just to be on the same scale.
Mm-hmm.
They have to work at least 25% harder to get noticed. They have a huge bunch of work-life adversarial challenges that men don't have in terms of baby-bearing, etc.
Mm.
And the system still doesn't get it, that they need safety landings at certain points of their life, so they just fade away.
Mm.
And that is, I think, the real problem. If you look at the stats,
mm-hmm.
One of the stats that I read was that India's women, over their life cycle, 48% of them ultimately leave their jobs. That is our leaky pipeline. Wow. 48%.
And do you have a sense of how that 48% happens through the journey?
The article didn't say when, but I can guess.
Sure.
Post-marriage, first baby.
Hmm.
Those are the critical times when a woman just finds it too difficult.
Hmm.
And therefore, unless the ecosystem and the organization, and more importantly, her husband, support her, she's gone.
And to make it tactical, specifically the role of the spouse, again, not that there's any silver bullet, but any headline thoughts on what you've seen supportive spouses do, just to make it real for the men out there?
Well, firstly, I think there are very few supportive spouses. They say they're supportive, but they're not supportive in the real sense. What do I mean by the real sense? The real sense is, the first thing is to make your wife happy. Okay? If you're just going to crib about it or act so sanctimonious as to what a great favor you're doing about it, it's not support. Mm. So the first thing is to actually appreciate the physical and mental trauma that a woman goes through and the guilt that she's asked to face and bear. And therefore, I think the spouses, especially today's generation spouses, that actually appreciate women much more in that sense than maybe two generations ago for sure.
Mm.
So what your grandfather thought of the role of women and what you think, good God, right? I mean, you couldn't compare.
Mm.
But I think to put that into practice in terms of physical support, mental breaks, happy, encouraging conversations or short vacations.
Hmm.
standing up in front of your parents' square when required, understanding that, you know, she could also have as hard a day as you could for many rights running, and that it's okay. I think that's where the men can really make a difference. So, speaking for myself, mm-hmm. I think my husband, by some lucky streak I got by the grace of God, just never had a problem with a successful wife. There was no sense of insecurity because he was a very successful mm-hmm. husband. Mm-hmm. And he was so sure in his skin of who he was mm-hmm. that my much more publicly visible profile amused him rather than bothered him. But how many men do you get like that, in not only in India, but in the world? And so I think it's a combination of choosing the right partner, if you can. And finally, if you can't, training him to be the right partner with affection and love. And therefore giving back as much as you get. Nobody's going to do it if you smack your husband. But if he loves you and he knows how important it is to you and you don't become overbearing,
right.
and it's not my way or the highway either.
Sure.
And it works. It's a partnership.
Got it. And just a related theme as sort of the work and the non-work life and how people draw lines around it. How have you thought about it? And specifically, I remember you saying specifically not taking an M&A negotiation home, but taking a litigation home. So I was curious about what you had in mind when you said that, but the broader theme being, how do you think about these two elements of your life?
You see, I've always said publicly, and I'm afraid I can't change my tune now, is that I had no work-life balance, and I've regretted it very often. But now I'm 61, and I can't do anything about it. And I think it was because I was so obsessive about wanting to be successful. I was so obsessive about making sure I didn't have a gender glass ceiling. And the only way I could do that, I felt, was just to overwork and overperform. Mm. And that meant time. And that time took me away from my family and a lot of other things. I'm a Baha'i by religion. I'm sure I'll go to hell for not doing enough. But how do you compensate? And the truth is you don't compensate. I think my family did feel they didn't have enough of me. We used to take small short holidays. And of course, I used to try and convince myself that it was the quality and not the quantity and all that nonsense. But it's not true. And so I think that, can this generation do better? I think the good news is that this generation is doing better. That's my complaint about this generation. Too little work. But, you know, the millennials have found their balance, right? They don't want to be Zia Modi or anybody else. They think it's crazy. And so they find their own life balance. And I think today's younger 30-year-old or 35-year-old, you would know better. You mix more with them. Are they that obsessive? No.
Again, it's a hit or a miss. And there are, I guess, you have a spectrum of people in any age cohort. But
you would have a few.
I hear you.
Who will always be obsessive. That's just their nature. But by and large, I think that this millennium takes no great pride in saying, I work so hard. They take much more pride in saying, I do have a life balance. And I think for us as women of my generation, you couldn't be successful and have that life balance. You had too much to prove.
But, I mean, you spoke about having a regret in terms of how you prioritize the two. If you went back in time, would you do it any differently with the wisdom of hindsight?
Who knows? Because it would all depend on whether I had wanted to get to where I was. If I wanted to get to where I was, and I was in that generation, I had no option. I was maybe one of four women in court. So how was I going to get counted? By going home at 6 o'clock? No. by taking a month off. No.
It's what you sign up for when you make that choice.
Exactly.
And back to this point about, again, the intensity of work. You know, the one of the other pieces I've been curious about as a consultant is generally how do you build empathy with the client without letting it affect your life? I'm sure a lot of the cases that you you take on, it's sort of, you know, at some level you need to own it, but at some level you need to also maintain a healthy distance.
You learn that. You learn that. So as you're younger, you get much more emotionally involved. And I think that's not a good thing. You should always have the client's confidence and always have the client's trust. That doesn't mean you have to be a sucker for what he says. A lot of clients embellish. Some just lie. And some of them are too naive. So you quickly become a reader of human beings as a successful lawyer, at least a lawyer. And you can smell and sense, and your antenna is up for the personality and character of the client sitting in front of you. You need to know when to cajole him, when to handhold him, when to smack the hell out of him, to tell him to get lost from your office. But by and large, to make him feel that you are his trusted advisor, that you are lawyer plus. That is really a lawyer's place in the sun. Today, I don't want to be known as a lawyer. I want to be known only as the trusted advisor of all my clients, not just one, all. Because they should be reaching out to me for that softer yes or no. Should I, shouldn't I? What do you think? And the answer is so important because you know it factors into their decision making.
That's very interesting because I used to be at McKinsey, whether it was that McKinsey or Evan Egon Zehnder or bankers. I guess a lot of the advisors are vying for that trusted advisor slot.
The most precious one.
And how do you, what's your sense in moving from just being that advisor who's the content person in that particular domain to being the trusted advisor who transcends domain?
Your judgment calls. Your judgment calls. So why would a client reach out to me for a yes or no on a deal? He wants my judgment call. He doesn't want my law. But I cannot give him that judgment call unless I have utter domain over that subject. So what do you think? Will the Reserve Bank come after me? Will the IRDA get upset? Will, you know, SEBI, what will SEBI think? I'm not SEBI. But they trust me to give them a fine sense of how SEBI will think. And so you sort of a little under their skin in terms of how much they value it. That's what you do. You just become a very trusted human being to their decision-making process.
But this notion of taking multiple, like you said, this notion of judgment, which is about dealing with a lot of fuzzy data and coming up with an on-balance decision. Is there a, what's been your experience in fine-tuning that muscle? If you had to talk about how business leaders could sharpen that sense of judgment over time, do you have any thoughts on how you've seen people sharpen it over time?
I think it's a combination of experience, learning from mistakes you've made, learning from mistakes other people have made, if you're observant enough, and continuing to get more and more mastery over the subject matter on which you make decisions. But if you ask me to make decisions on some economic theory, I can't, right? And there's no point in saying I have a gut. How's my gut relevant unless it's peppered with domain?
Right. So it's a combination of sharpening the domain expertise with sort of reflection.
Yeah, I mean, without the domain, you really can't make a judgment call.
And the other quote which has stayed with me is a professor in Harvard called Professor Joseph Badoracco. And he actually says, early in a career, in any profession, often the decisions are about right versus wrong. But as you grow in tenure, they're often about right versus right. And that's when, you know, it sort of the men get separated from the boys or women from the girls. Any, again, back to the field of law, any reflections on how some
so that's the nuancing. Well? I think that's the nuancing probably that I would put in the context of the law, you know, right and right. So the law is the law. But then how are you applying it in an absolutely refined manner to the facts of the case in front of you and nuancing every angle? That's the way you do that. You max that.
And the other skill I'm curious about, which I think lawyers possess in abundance, is this notion of influencing and storytelling, right? In a lot of ways, especially when you go to court and when you're arguing. Again, any reflections on what some of the lawyer, the distinctive lawyers do well from a storytelling and an influencing perspective?
Well, you said it, right? Great lawyers are great orators and have a complete mastery over the language, are able to turn a judge by virtue of a humorous joke, to give a story which is context with what is going on, thinking on your feet, understanding that if your best argument is falling flat, you turn to the next one and the next one and the next one. Can you find something that convinces the judge, if you can? So therefore, you've got to be very alert, very flexible, change tunes, keep wearing different hats. You're just an actor. Shakespeare.
Very interesting. And how much of this is, again, from a leadership development perspective in the field of law, how much of this is left to learning on the job versus specifically honing these skill sets? How do you think about that in the context of building out AZB?
So I think every youngster starts learning on the job. Because, you know, knowing law in theory is one thing, but seeing it applied to each case after the other is another. I think without the practical, how can you be successful anyway? So I think you really learn more on the job.
And specifically, the other theme I'm curious about is inflection points in a lawyer's career where the term what got you here doesn't get you there. Again, in a, if I were to take a consulting metaphor, there's a point where you start moving from being a good consultant yourself to leading people, and then you start moving from leading people to selling business or winning business and so on. Similarly, if, are there...
Very similar. I don't think that path changes terribly for lawyers.
I guess it's a similar advisory services...
Yeah, exactly. The service provider.
...context. So I want to talk about building out AZB, Zia. Again, in India, I was talking to Nanda Nilekani a few weeks back, and he made an interesting statement, which India has a lot of startups, but fewer scale-ups. Again, as you think about your transition from being a successful lawyer to a successful entrepreneur who's built an institution, and reflect on your personal journey as a leader, again, talk to us a little bit about how you've changed, how you've evolved, and how you've sort of, let's say, built your leadership muscle in that transition from being a successful lawyer to a successful entrepreneur.
I think it was a question of taking a call that I wanted to scale. So if I'd stayed at 15, 20 lawyers, my entire motivation and mindset would have, of course, been very different. I would have been a crazy boutique with a Rottweiler instinct for my particular subject. But I think at some stage, my partner Bairam and I took a call that we wanted to grow, that there was enough opportunity in India for sure. And so, you know, within 20 years, we've grown from 12 to 400.
Wow.
So that's really India's story. We grew like India grew. But therefore, there are mindset changes. There are leadership changes. You have to still be a leader that is seen with affection, even though now you cannot remember everybody's birthday and what their kids are doing, which you could when you had only 15 lawyers. The connect was much stronger. And so how do you keep that bond of maybe not intense affection, but affection?
And how have you managed to do that with a team of 400?
I think that I just don't sleep.
Comes back to the same theme.
That's right. Caring, having your doors open, listening to someone who's going through a bad life in the marriage space, children are rebelling, mother-in-law not listening, everything. You suppose more because you're a woman, you tend to be a friend, somewhat of a counselor, definitely a psychologist, to as many men as women.
Hmm.
But I think it's the perception that you leave with your organization that you're there.
Hmm.
And that if there really is a crisis, either at work or very often at home, you're not going to stand at the door looking busy and saying, yes, yes, now what, now what?
Hmm.
And that just takes time.
True. Moving beyond the transaction and just the case in hand to really talking about what's top of mind for them and solving for...
And solving issues very often, you know. And gone are the days when you can just act like a aggressive leader. People can move. People have options. You want to retain people because you genuinely like them.
Mm.
And so how do you display that if it's genuine? It's time.
And when you reflect on AZB's journey, 12 to 400, are there one or two inflection points where, pivotal moments, if I may say, where you had to take significant calls to really determine the trajectory? Are there one or two moments in time that you would recall?
I don't think there are particular moments in time, but the thought pattern which, you know, one had to get over was exactly this, small or big.
Hmm.
Because a lot was going to change for me personally.
Mm.
There would be a lot of people management. My passion for law would no longer be 100% of my day.
Mm.
It would be maybe 20%, 30% of my day.
Mm.
I would have to spend a lot of time, as you say, in getting business.
Mm.
And I would love being a lawyer much more than that.
Mm.
So those sort of reality checks.
Mm.
But the truth of the matter is that, you know, in a way, it all came so flowingly.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was just simply because the work just kept coming.
Mm.
So if work keeps coming, how do you limit yourself to 12? Right. If you go from 12 to 40, then you go from 40 to 70. Work keeps coming. Then you worry that work may stop, so you go out and get it. Then you keep going out and getting it. Then you need more people.
So the flywheel is on, yeah.
A lot of the decision-making in my life was to consciously know that when we morphed from a small firm into the firm of the size that we are today, a lot of things would change for many of us. A lot of my partners who were with me on my journey in the beginning are still here with me.
Hmm.
They also reminisce about the days when we were all in one room eating cold pizza at 3 o'clock in the morning. That doesn't happen so much anymore because the pyramid is clearer, the delegation is clearer, etc., etc., etc. But you know, you can't also reflect. You can't turn away opportunity.
Right.
You have to deal with reality.
Hmm.
You're growing. There's more growth. There's more growth.
Hmm.
That's exciting in and of itself.
Hmm.
But that comes with repercussions. Change of intimacy in the organization. And, you know, more of a business-like approach, if you like. But somehow you try and keep the balance. You still try and keep the affection. Not only me personally, but the pyramid as such. And you hope that that DNA translates.
And what else? Couple of questions wrapping up, Zia. One is, if you really had to be immodest about yourself and say what about you has enabled you to come this far in your career and build such an institution, what are the 2-3 themes you would call out?
I would think my tenacity, my loathing to admit failure, my ability to leverage my intelligence tactically rather than abrasively.
Mm.
my conscious strategic recognition that as a woman I had to do plus plus.
Mm.
And not fretting and moaning about it, but getting on with it.
Mm.
Being practical in many cases and not standing on my principles and my ego. Mm. That's it.
Mm. And how do you think about resilience? It means different things to different people. When you say tenacity and resilience, give us a sense of what it means.
You know, if someone's being obnoxious, I really don't care.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm wrong, I'm very happy to say sorry. It doesn't take the hell out of me. Mm. If someone's gaming me, I don't wait to let him think he's fooled me. I call him out. Mm. If I need to give guidance, which can't be sugar-coated beyond a point, I don't sugarcoat it beyond the point.
Hmm.
But I think, you know, I'm impatient.
Hmm.
I'm sometimes often bad-tempered. I don't suffer fools gladly. And, you know, those are my problem areas.
It's interesting you say this because one of the other points you made was about using your intelligence tactfully and not abrasively. So how do you...
So that is when I'm on the other side and I'm negotiating.
Mm-hmm.
I'm basically not going to get upset if the other person is a fool. I'm going to leverage that to my client's advantage. But if I'm mentoring somebody or training a youngster and they just don't get it after 2-3 attempts, then I lose interest.
Understood. It depends on which side of the fence the person is. Got it. Lavizia, this podcast is about playing to potential. And the two questions leaders ask often are where to go and how to grow. So in summary, any themes you want to leave the listeners with on the choices they make in their career and how they grow to play to their potential?
So I think obviously the main thing, are you passionate about it or you will not sustain? Don't be worried about changing tack.
Hmm.
If you find that you've done 5 years of something and you don't like it, you don't have to do the next 50.
Hmm.
Have the courage to take a step back. Doesn't matter if you lose in the race. But ultimately, it'll sustain.
Hmm.
And, you know, contrary to what anybody might like to think, there's absolutely no substitute for hard work.
Hmm.
That's it. So that's how you grow.
Absolutely. Pleasure talking to you, Zia. Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure.
The biggest takeaway for me in this conversation was that there are no shortcuts in life, however cliched it sounds. Sometimes you just have to put in the hours, and sometimes you can't have it all, unfortunately. And the notion of work-life balance sometimes is not feasible if you're chasing dreams that require you to clock the hours. Coming to terms with it and being practical about it, as Zia says, is key. One of my earlier guests on the show was Viren Raskina, who used to play hockey for India and is now the CEO of Olympic Gold Quest. When I asked him about what gave resilience to top athletes, he spoke about the power of why. He said that the elite athletes all had a very clear sense of why they were going for the medal, and that clarity gave them the tenacity to run through a brick wall every single day. Having that clarity around the why behind the what is often so critical for us to lead a life of impact and meaning. Hope you found the conversation purposeful. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations of the Play to Potential podcast series. Bye now.